Hi, folks. This is Lauren Hunt with another episode of the Guitar Podcast. Thanks for tuning in again. This is episode number 46. For those of you new to the Guitar Podcast, I want you to know that when I talk about guitars and amps and pedals and music and all, I'm conveying my opinion from my experience and learning over the years. Please email me with questions at info@theguitarpodcast.net. Chime in with comments and such on the show notes at theguitarpodcast.net/blog. Follow the Guitar Podcast on Facebook. Last but not least, go to guitarpodcast.net and sign up for email alerts, where you'll get emails notifying you when a new episode has been released and other timely information regarding the Guitar Podcast. Oh, a footnote back to the emailing me with questions. If you email me with a question, you're automatically added to the email alerts list. Also, if you like what you hear here, send the link to your friends or post it on your blog or whatever. Share the love. Let people know what's going on here. All right, let's get to it. Today we got a special treat. I'm here sitting at Six Strings Down in Plainfield talking with Dave Bryant. How you doing, Dave?
Fine, Lauren. How are you?
I'm all right. I met Dave back in 2000, and about this time of year, about, I'd say, late May, early June 2000, and I picked up a Strat and a Tele off of him, and actually, I think I met him before then, but that was like the first big deal I got. I made with Dave. I was very happy with those guitars, and a little bit of background. It's a used shop, used vintage, and a few new things, new accessories, of course. But one of the things I've always loved about this place, and I've always told people about whenever they go, hey, well, I'm looking for guitars or whatever, say, have you been to Six Strings Down in Plainfield? And like, well, what's that? Where's that? And tell them about it. I say, go see Dave. Tell him I sent you. And if he doesn't throw you out, then I know we're still on good terms, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of people feel that way. But I appreciate all the bones that get thrown my way, and I enjoy what I do, and thanks to anybody who's listening, who's sent me people, it helps keeps things moving, and that's the way we like it. So it keeps it fresh for everybody.
One of the things I really like about coming in here is you never know what you're going to see, and that, I mean, I think that's probably true for a lot of used shops, but it's almost like Christmas morning every time I come in. I mean, there's some things that are still here week in, week out, but you know, it's like, oh man, that cool guitar is gone, you know, and then the other times I come in, I'm like, wow, that's cool, you know, something's different all the time.
Well, that's what keeps us going. I mean, and when I say us, I mean all of us, because it's not a drudgery for me to get up and go to work in the morning. I have been there. I won't lie to anyone about that, but because of the fact I never know from 1 minute or 1 hour to the next, even during the course of the day, what may walk through my door. And that keeps it interesting for me just as well as it does my customers. So, you know, that's one goal that I've always tried to keep in mind with this place, is to keep a nice variety of stuff in here for everybody, from the bare bones beginner player up to the guy who owns 20 or 30 or more guitars and is always looking for something that he doesn't have or something a little bit different. It just keeps it interesting for all of us all the way around, and that's the way I like it.
Yeah, yeah. So when did you open up Six Strings Down?
I opened up August of 97.
At a different location?
At a different location, yes. I was in downtown Plainfield at the time. The thought had crossed my mind. We had not had a store in town at that point in time, I think for 2 or 3 years at least. And I thought we needed a store, and I didn't want to go the new route. So I decided to go this way, and had done most of my shopping in stores like this. And it just seemed like a better way to go all the way around. So that's what I decided to do, and everything just kind of fell into place. A place downtown opened up, and a friend of mine had a business not far from there, and he told me that it was going to come open. So I got the contact name and number and contacted the fella, and he was very anxious to rent it. So the rest is history, so to say. And In October of 2005, I moved to the present location here, which is roughly 10 blocks east of where I was downtown. And it worked out good. I basically had run out of room. The guy that owned the building was wanting to sell the building, and I moved out. He sold the building a month later, and I got three times the space that I had being where I'm at now. So it worked all the way around. So there's a reason for everything.
Yeah. This is a really, really nice new facility you have here. A lot more wide open. I always liked the other place, but it was a little cramped.
And it kept getting more cramped as time went on, which there's a lot of people like that kind of thing. And I'm one of them. I'm the guy that you see at flea markets and garage sales under the tables and looking behind, you know, drapes and that kind of thing. And there's a lot of us out there. But overall, I think this is actually a better setup all the way around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really nice. So you were working a regular 9-to-5 beforehand. And what, I mean, you said that we need a guitar shop here in Plainfield. What told you that you needed to be the guy to do that?
Well, I don't know that anything told me I needed to be the guy, but it didn't seem like anybody else was going to. And it was, I don't know. Of course, I've played guitar since the Mayflower landed. So it just seemed like it was, maybe the timing was right. And I just took a chance. I mean, it's like anything else. You know, today when you change jobs, you don't know if it's going to work out or not. I didn't know then if it was going to work out or not, but we're, you know, right now we're just shy of 14 years, so evidently it's something's worked out right. And I feel extremely thankful for that. So.
Yeah, it's been great, but going from corporate American job A to corporate American job B it's almost like You know, I mean, there's stress and some anxiety involved in that. But launching out on your own business venture in guitars, and of course, what's really cool is you started out right near the beginning of the hockey stick in the vintage market when things were really not. Weren't really looking at things as being terribly expensive unless it was a 50s or 60s piece. It was
right.
Special.
And I look back now, and I wish I'd have had the, of course, hindsight's 20/20, but I wish I would have had the wherewithal back then to have had the foresight to say, yeah, I'm just going to buy all these and put them someplace and just keep them. But, you know, it's one of those things that's tough enough when you start a business anyway. I mean, when I opened the store up, other than the accessory stuff that I ended up getting new, I had 12 guitars and 6 amps. That's exactly what I had. And part of that was my personal stuff that I put on the wall to make it at least look like I had something in the store.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've had, I don't know, a lot of good breaks along the way. I always have said I'd rather be lucky than good any day of the week. And I've been extremely lucky in being at the right place at the right time a lot of ways. I had just barely been open, I don't know, maybe a month, and I got word that a fellow was selling out, and my store just ballooned overnight. I went from just having a few pieces to you almost couldn't walk through the place, and that created a buzz, and that helped, you know, and without that, I'm not saying I wouldn't be here today, but it sure didn't hurt anything getting things rolling, so to say, and people to know about the store and creating an interest. And like it or not, I don't care how big or how small you are, that's what you want to do with any business is create an interest to get people to come to your business.
Mm-hmm. You know, and each one, you know, most of the success stories, there's a fuel waiting to be ignited.
Hmm.
And yours was when that business, when you took on all that inventory, that was a spark.
Exactly.
It ignited all that fuel.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I read about how George Groon got started. I mean, it was just a little bit at a time, and all of a sudden, the next thing you know, a spark was lit by, maybe spark lit the fuel whenever Celebrity A said, hey, I want to buy some guitars from you.
Well,
you know
I think a lot of people seem to forget. And of course, it only makes sense. Most people working 8 to 5, you know, of some sort. And that's what they do, and that's what they're going to do, and that's fine. But in the same breath, I'll also tell you that they don't understand the trials and tribulations that go along with starting your own business, so on and so forth. And because of that fact, you know, you hear a household name. And in this business, you know, you've got guys like George Groom, who George has always been extremely friendly and open to me with advice anytime I've had the opportunity to talk to him, which I've greatly appreciated. But, you know, in the computer world, Bill Gates, and, you know, you can go on and on and on. And people seem to forget that they weren't always on top of their game. They all started at the same place. But you forget about the story that started at point A, and you're up to point M or X or wherever you want to go. And it's like, hey, these guys were on top of the world. Well, they weren't always there. And it, you know, it's depending on how the business is and what you do, sometimes it can be extremely lucrative. And for most small businesses, it's just a day-to-day, you know, try to be comfortable and get by and keep going. And as long as you can do that and your business is growing a little bit, then I think you've done okay.
Yeah. And back to your point about George Groon, anytime I've emailed him, he's gotten back to me the next day, and sometimes less than 24 hours, most of the time less than 24 hours, and I was blown away by that. I'd ask him questions about things, and it was like, wow, you know. You know,
George has forgotten more than most people will ever know about,
absolutely,
you know, particularly vintage instruments. And, you know, George is one of those guys, because he's been around for so long, he, to some people, he seems a little short, sometimes with answers, or maybe a little trite, and he's not that way. I mean, I don't want to speak for George, but at the same time, like I said, he's always been extremely friendly and open to me. But he just is an unbelievable walking encyclopedia of stuff. And if you ever get the chance to meet him and say hello, and if he's got a few minutes to be able to talk to you, I think you'll see that George is a very warm person. But he is also very down to earth. He pulls no punches with. There's not much of a gray area. It's right or wrong on a lot of this stuff, and that's just the way it is. And because of he comes across that way, some people take that wrong.
Sure.
And I think anybody in a situation of knowledge in any sort of any business can come off that way to people who really aren't in the know.
Mm-hmm. Now, Beck, we were talking about how the vintage market from mid-90s, and especially through the mid-2000s, mm-hmm, where it just went into the hockey stick mode until it was just insane prices in, say, 2006 and 7, that, you know, you hear all these stories about people back, you know, back in the 50s or 60s, they buy, you know, say a 62 Strat or something to that level, or a 57 Strat or whatever. Like, I only paid, you know, $200
sure,
for it or something,
exactly,
like that back then, and now it's worth, you know, I could buy a car with it now. And it was really, you know, when you hear something take place over 30 years, okay, I understand inflation and then the value that the instrument was really good, but it was really interesting to me to look at the cost of used gear that I bought in here back in like 2000, 2001, 2002, and how, you know, I spent $500 on a 76 SG Standard,
mm-hmm,
and you can't get one for that.
Can't buy them today for $500. I
no
know.
No way. And well, I sold it for $500.
Sure.
And I'm going.
And you know, we've all done that. And,
but
you
it's
know,
funny how it just went so fast.
Sure. And you
and
know,
even today, it's a down market. But is it?
Well, it is to a point, but of course, it's like. It's just like the stock market, and I don't ever want to make people think that guitars are like stocks, because guitars are made to be played. That's first and foremost. You kind of put everything else away, and if you get lucky enough to find one of those holy grail type pieces, then so be it. But bottom line is, they were made to play and make music on. They're for your enjoyment, and hopefully for others around you, for them to enjoy your playing. And If it does that, then that particular guitar has done its job. Some of this stuff has gotten completely out of line. There's no doubt. And I think a lot of things are back in line now, if you will. Yes, antiques, there are things in this business that are absolute no-nos compared to others. You know, vintage cars, it's kind of a given that they're completely restored. Now, I'm not saying that one in completely original, excellent condition wouldn't bring more money than a restored one, but restorations in that line of stuff is, it's just commonplace. You do that to a guitar, you've just totally, completely annihilated the value of that piece. And it doesn't, again, we're looking at value instead of playing ability, so on and so forth. So it just depends on how you look at it. I came across a piece not long ago, and it was a great player, great sounding guitar, and it was a late 50s Strat. But it had been refinished. And, you know, that just completely took quite a bit off the value, and it just didn't make it as lucrative to jump on that piece. Now, if you try to buy it as a player's piece, of course, everybody has a computer today for the most part, and that makes everybody an expert in every field. I don't care what you do. And you can't always believe what you read, and they don't understand a lot of the ins and outs on this stuff. That's where things get a little amiss sometimes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you take it all in stride and you just hope that everybody can walk away smiling. And as long as you can do that, then it's been a good day.
Yeah, sure. Now, I've heard, when you're talking about refinishes, mm-hmm. I've heard some arguments for that it certainly would diminish the value, but not as much as, they're saying that it's not as much as what we're seeing there. It shouldn't do it as much, but that's just an argument on that side. And I'm sure you're going to have both sides of the coin arguing back and forth.
To a point, I agree with that. You know, I mean, I'll be honest with you. Again, you have to look at this from two different perspectives. If you're looking at it from a collector's standpoint, then everything has to be original and in as good a quality condition as possible. On the other side of that, there are people that want older guitars to actually play because, yes, the wood is aged, the electronics are aged, they sound better. Like it or not, they sound better and most of them play better. People don't understand this somewhat until they really get into this, but the average player can't pay collector price for said guitar. So, unfortunately, what they were actually made for, the guy that really wants one to play can't afford to buy one. That's just the way it is. It's kind of an upside-down situation, but it's that way within the realm of a lot of collectibles, not just musical instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can, it's not just guitars. You can get into saxophones and violins and so on and so forth. There's a value on some of these that are just astronomical. And I'm not saying that they're not worth that, but it's a very, very small percentage of people who could ever even think about owning one.
Right. I mean, you're talking about $300,000 plus for a 59 Les Paul.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just,
you know, or a million plus for a Stradivarius, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, who are we kidding here?
Exactly.
Really.
Yeah.
But yeah, my understanding is that whenever a guitar is refinished, it's more detrimental to the value than, say, a pot needs resoldered or a pot needs replaced. But you have the original pickups or something like that. It needs rewired. I mean, if you have new solder points, that's going to probably diminish some of the value. But if
and,
you really
you know,
still want to play
again, and George has said this many times before, one of the best examples in this market is a lot of the old Martins, of course, did not have truss rods. And sometimes they just get to the place where the action almost gets unplayable on them. And the only way to remedy that is to reset the neck. Well, okay, yes, the neck has been reset on this 1945 Martin, but at the same time, it's now a playable instrument again. And if the next set is done by a professional who knows exactly what he's doing, then there's no detriment to me in the value. The detriment to me is more so in the fact you've got a piece that you can't play.
Yes.
What good is it if you can't play it? So, you know, it all kind of goes hand in hand. At the same time, don't take your 1961 Strat and take it out in the garage and repaint it and go put new pickups in it. You know, that's a no-no. But, I mean, at the same time, things have to be playable to have any kind of an intrinsic value at all with these instruments.
Mm-hmm. And then that when you're talking about taking your 60s Strat, and I mean, I'm sure that a lot of people were cringing in the 80s when they were taking their routers to them and putting putting humbuckers in the bridge and routing the nut for a locking nut and putting a Floyd Rose in there.
I know,
for the most part, it was ready for a Floyd Rose. It just, you needed new pull posts for the screws and stuff.
It's funny you bring that up because I have a customer, and if he listens to this, he's cringing or rolling on the floor laughing right now, and I'll leave that at that. I'm not even going to throw a name out. I'll leave it alone because it's a personal joke between the two of us and has been for years. So,
yeah. I remember reading when I was in high school, back when all that was going on, I was like, you had to have a Super Strat. You
know? Sure.
And then people older and wiser than me going, I can't believe they're doing this to these guitars or why they were wanting to, you know, and I'm going, well, because it's a hot rod. It could do all these cool things, and now I get it.
Well, you do, and, you know, it's one of those things you look back and when you look back you can go back to the 30s with Charlie Christian, Django, those kind of people, but you really hit the big guitar boom. You go to the mid-50s, and you start looking at stuff, and there's a lot of those guys, even back then, who became, quote, guitar stars, if you will. But there's a lot of guitars played by a lot of different players who a lot of us have idolized over the years, but they were absolute mongrel guitars because of the fact, even though they were stars back then, they didn't make that kind of money that stars make today, so to say. So, you know, when a pickup died, you just put another pickup in it because that was your working tool. You had to have that guitar to play. If the neck got broken, you put another neck on it, you know, and so on and so forth. So I always try to keep that in consideration. Of course, in almost 14 years, I've had guitars in every shape of disconfigurement you could ever imagine. And part of them have been legitimate because they were a working man's tool. And, you know, I remember when I was playing back in the 70s, there were a lot of places in town that had music six nights a week. That's how those guys made their living. And even though they never became stars, they relied on the guitars or a bass or a drum set or whatever the case may be. Well, if you're playing Wednesday night and something breaks, you got to play tomorrow night, so you hustle and fix things as best as you can. That's the way it was, because a lot of those guys didn't have money for two guitars. You know, they worked to get a good guitar, and that was their guitar.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it was. So you try to keep all of it into consideration, and as long as they didn't kill them too bad, it was okay.
Yeah. Well, I understand the working man musician, not making much money, and you're doing what you can with what you had. Because I had an Aria Pro 2, RS Warrior 1 or whatever, and I still have it, but definitely not a pro level guitar. But I was playing out with it, and it sounded great.
Sure.
I replaced the pickup with a DiMarzio Super Distortion, sounded really good. But I put my money towards the amp.
Right.
So the amp has to sound really good. I could more than likely plug anything into it. It's gonna sound like it should sound, but you know, I was really attached to that guitar, and I did all kinds of crazy, stupid mods to it. I think you've seen it.
Well, but, yeah, I have.
But that wasn't what, that was a 62 Strat that I brought in and was doing all kinds of crazy things too. But
well, yeah, and if you want a prime example of a guitar like that, I mean, look at Steve Morse's old Tele. You know, here you've got a Telecaster with four pickups in it and switches and this, that, and the other, but that guitar will do almost anything and everything that he ever wanted it to do. Now, of course, he's got his Music Man signature model now, but that was when he had to do to that guitar to make it do what he needed it to do to keep making his living. There's a prime example.
What year was that guitar?
I don't even remember. I remember the first time I saw it, I thought, my Lord, what did this guy do with these pickups? And then the more I read about it, the more it made sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think Andy Summers, his guitar, his Tele that he was mm-hmm. going for through his career with the Police is heavily modified, but it wasn't quite so obvious.
Right.
No, but I mean, you could see, if you look close enough, you see switches and extra knobs and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And you're going, some kind
of, you know,
of
and there's
going
a lot
on.
Of those guitars that have been that way. I mean, one of Page's Les Pauls had buttons underneath the pick guard to tap the pickups and do this and do that, because a lot of the early Zeppelin stuff he recorded on a Telecaster, then went to the Les Paul or the double neck, and to get the sounds that he wanted, that was the way you did that. So basically he took the Les Paul and made it into as close of a Telecaster and Les Paul as he possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same kind of thing that a lot of guys have done over the years.
And he used two Les Pauls,
yes.
A 58 and a 59.
Mm-hmm.
The 59 was given to him by Joe Walsh.
I believe that's correct, yes.
I'm hoping that he modified the 58 to be coil tapped. Not that it would matter to Jimmy Page.
Well, no, because like it or not, those guitars, I know one of them, has had the headstock broken or cracked on it.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Rossington's 59 has had the headstock broken off of it. The janitor fixed it for him. You know, I mean, it's just one of those things. But those guitars were what those guys, again, made their living with.
Mm-hmm.
And you never thought about that. I mean, how many guys do you know that take a screwdriver to raise the action on a guitar to play slide on? The song that we've all heard a million times, that's what Rossington did with his SG, or his early SG Les Paul, that he played slide on Freebird on. He put a screwdriver to raise the action up. There you go. Innovation at its best.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I think that's one of those things that kind of goes hand in hand with being a guitar player. You kind of tinker with things and make it work to however it's
sure.
going to be.
Sure, and you know, that's part of the fun of this too, is particularly today. You know, you can take one guitar and make it into, within reason, whatever you want it to be, because of the fact you've got humbucker pickups that are single coil sized and humbucker pickups that are regular sized that are tappable. So, I mean, there's just endless opportunities that you have to do with your guitar whatever you want it to do. And, of course, there's pieces and parts. You can build your own guitar with whatever body profile, neck profile, fret size, pickup configuration. You know, it's endless.
It's a great time to be a guitar player.
Absolutely it is. And it's a lot of fun.
In some ways, I wish I was a teenager now, because then I could, I mean, with YouTube, all the stuff you can learn on YouTube.
I know the stuff we wore records out on trying to learn, they can learn in an hour.
Yes, they have a guy going, yeah, I did.
Yeah, do
you know,
this.
and how it's kind of like whenever people were passing around tabs in school, in high school, you get at home and you start playing, it's like, okay, that's not quite right, but that's close. Okay,
see, this
is a good start.
And you're young enough, you had tab. We never had tab.
Didn't have tab.
I'm the old guy. So.
No, I can't imagine what it was like before tab, and I'm sure that teenagers now are going, I can't imagine what learning guitar was before YouTube, and then the in between, before the Hot Licks VHSs came out.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing those in the magazines, going, "Man, that'd be really cool to
have."
Yeah. I mean, that was by that time. I was like, "I'm, you know,
well,
I was pretty much really doing fairly well with it." And then I started teaching, and somebody showed me. He handed me about three or four of his, And I was like, oh, wow, that's really, really good stuff in there beyond what you can, of course, learn. But there are so many resources, whether you go into your local guitar shop and getting guitar lessons from a guy and getting that one-on-one interaction, as well as talking to a knowledgeable store owner.
Correct.
And then YouTube. And then those videos,
you
can purchase the Hot Licks videos. And
the only thing holding someone back from playing today basically is themselves, from, you know, a time constraint, or they just don't have the time to do it. Or, and on occasion, and I never used to believe this, but there are people that, and don't anybody take this wrong, because I'm not pointing fingers at anybody, I'm just stating fact. There are people that seriously just cannot learn to play guitar. They just have no musical ability at all. As much as they would love to do it, you know, they just don't have that kind of ability. They're few and far between, but you do run across one every now and then. But like you said, for the most part, if you've got a little bit of time, you know, I mean, we've got kids that come in here and start, and I mean, within a year, it's just unbelievable what they can do when they started at ground zero a year ago. And my Lord, listen to what this kid's playing today. And then on the other hand, you've got the guy that's wanted to play guitar for 40 years, but was working one or two jobs and raising a family and so on and so forth, and really never had time to do it. And they come in and go, okay, I retired last week. I've put this off for 40 years. Now here's the scoop. I'm not going to be a professional guitar player, but I want to learn to play. I want to learn a handful of chords and to get my rhythm down. And I want to sit around the campfire in the summertime and sing songs. And that's fine. There's not a thing in the world wrong with that. You know, everybody has their own outlook on how they want to go about this. Bottom line is, as long as you're happy with what you're doing and you're having fun, that's what counts.
I'm totally on board with that.
Yes. You know, I think, and don't get me wrong, I think, to me, it's like driving a car. I think if you get a driver's license, there are certain things that you should know. You should know how to change a tire if you have a flat. There are people that don't. So there's certain mechanics that I think you should know that go along with that, and I feel the same way about playing guitar. There are certain things that you should know, or at least let it come to you as you go along, and that's not saying that you have to overwork yourself or completely cast everything else aside and just put all your efforts towards playing guitar, but I think there are some things that kind of go hand in hand with learning that make the experience a lot more enjoyable if you have all that together.
And you understand the instrument a lot better,
exactly,
too.
Yeah.
And how it works, which I think in some way, understanding it on a deeper level makes you a better player, will help you out and get your ear going.
It does. And, you know, I've always said, and again, I understand because I've worked jobs where I worked fairly long hours, and you just really don't have time just to stop and take a lesson, or you won't have a half hour a night to just sit down and play guitar. But for the people who do this on their own, and they either are taking online lessons, or they get some of the new instructional books with CDs and or DVDs that go along with them, there's a lot of good information in those, but nothing will ever take the place of one-on-one instruction with a good instructor, because I don't care how far along you get on your own, it's what I call you run into the proverbial brick wall. There will just come a point in time when all of a sudden nothing makes sense, or I've gotten to this point and I can't go any farther. What am I doing wrong? You're not doing anything wrong. You've just kind of reached a road, and all of a sudden it forks out four different ways, and you don't know which way to go.
Right.
And I think that's one of the big things that I think where an instructor can make a world of difference in how much you can learn and enjoy what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I can totally agree with that. Especially, I mean, I'm a teacher.
It's only
one night a week, but I totally get that. And I experienced that firsthand when I was a kid. It was, you know, learning from other kids that I, you know, played guitar with, had magazines, was going through those, listening to my tapes, and trying to play along with the audio tapes and learn from those. Mm-hmm. But you know, every Tuesday night, 7 o'clock, I was going in and having my guitar lessons, and that one-on-one interaction was really key. And I you know, to that point, what you were just talking about, and several months ago, maybe it even been last year, that I read this article about being a good teacher or having a good teacher, knowing where the rubber meets the road. Mm-hmm. But a guy came to his teacher, and he was wanting to be a professional. I think he was wanting to go to Juilliard or something like mm-hmm. that. He was really wanting to
sure.
take it to that really
that level
top
that
level.
Most people don't, sure.
And he was wanting to get into a certain competition, high-level competition, guitar competition. And he went to the guy, and he played his pieces for him, and the teacher may not have been on that level anyway, but it doesn't matter. The teacher was there to look and watch him play and go, you need to fix this, and you need to fix that. And the guy was like, those are major fixes. And it was totally clear to him that he was not ready to make that step to
sure.
that high-level competition or to go to Juilliard or whatever it was.
Exactly.
But the thing is that it wasn't that the teacher was going, you're not good enough, you got it. No, it's,
no,
let's fix this.
Sure.
And I've done that. You know, and that's I did that before, but I really focus on that now as a teacher. That's like whenever I'm watching my student, I'm not wanting to go, no. It's like, what's one key thing that's going to help them between now and next week?
Well, yeah, and not only that, but I think the big thing is most people do this as a hobby. Like it or not, I mean, you know, most of us that play, we don't really make our living just playing guitar.
Absolutely.
Solo, in a band, you know, in Vegas, well, whatever the case may be. So, like it or not, we are hobbyists.
Right.
And I think most of us want to be at least up to a point where we can be as good as we can be, but some of us never quite get there because of fill in the blank. There's a million different answers for that. But bottom line is, when somebody starts playing guitar, from an instructor standpoint, and this is one thing I've stressed to all my instructors, and they're extremely good about it, you've got to make sure that they're enjoying what they're doing.
Absolutely.
You know, it's just like anything else in life. If you're not enjoying this, then maybe you need to find something else to do. And I've told kids, you know, they come in here and, you know, playing guitar is a great thing all the way around. But what most particularly young kids don't understand, that 50 years from now, you won't drag your piano down the street, but you can take your guitar anywhere with you. On vacation, out to the woods, wherever you want to go. It can be your best friend when all your friends are gone, and it will never leave you alone. It'll be there for you whenever you want it to be there. It can be your own little getaway, late at night, stressful day at work. It can fix everything. So it's got to be an enjoyable situation. And I think sometimes there's too much emphasis put on we have to do this, this, and this. Let's make it fun, you know. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think good school teachers are the same way. The school teachers that I always held dear to my heart were the ones that I always learned so much more in their class because of that little extra they threw in there to make the learning so much more enjoyable, rather than just the drudgery of learning.
Mm-hmm.
Guitar teachers are the same way.
Yeah, it's got to be fun. They
exactly.
have to be having fun.
Yes, it does.
If you're not having fun, why are you doing it?
Well,
what are you doing?
And I'll be honest with you. I know there's people that come in here, and when they come in for the first time or the second time, whatever, they probably think I'm a little nonchalant when they come in because I'm not a high-pressure salesman, and I don't want to be. Because when you come in here, I want you to take your time, look around, make yourself at home. And I tell people that. And, whoa, wait a minute. You're not on me to buy something immediately. No, and I'm not going to be. Yes, I appreciate your business, and I want you to buy things off of me. And hopefully I'll have something here that you'll want to buy. But that's going to be your decision, and I'm here to help you with that decision, not make the decision for you. So, you know, I just want everybody to be comfortable. It's the same kind of thing. I want them to enjoy their experience coming in here to make a purchase, as well as my students that come in here with my instructors. I want them to enjoy their guitar lessons.
And first time walking into a guitar store to buy a guitar or interested in buying a guitar can be a very intimidating experience.
Oh, absolutely it can.
Even as high as maybe buying a new car, or maybe even worse.
Oh, I think it's
because you have no
worse.
Idea about a guitar.
Nope.
I mean, at least you've driven a car before, right? Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, because I've known guitar stores in the past where you walked in and you'd had that trepidation, that anxiety walking in, and the guy bites your head off or is just like makes you feel like a complete fool. And I've always hated that. And there's still places like that, but they're not. I think they're a lot less than they used to be.
And not just guitar stores. I mean, there's any kind of store you can think of to purchase anything you want to talk about. There are places that are that way.
Yeah.
So, you know, and some are and some aren't, and that's just not my cup of tea. So.
And I think it's key to make somebody feel comfortable in a retail environment.
Sure.
To make them feel, it's like, hey, I'll answer any of your questions and help you out with this and try to guide you through. But, you know, just take a look around. Let me know what you know.
Absolutely.
I think it's a great approach.
And that's what I tell most people.
Yeah. How many teachers do you have here?
I have four teachers.
Four teachers?
Yep.
Very cool.
Yep, and I've got a nice broad spectrum on my teaching staff. Young guys to, I don't want to say old guys, but older seasoned guys, I guess I would
say.
Works. They're all musicians and have been. I mean, one of my guys makes his living playing and teaching. That's what he does. I've got another guy that's same way. One guy made his living strictly playing for about 25 years. And so they know the ins and outs, and they know how to get across to the students. I'm extremely pleased with my instructors. I think I've got a nice overall base, and we can pretty much cover not everything, but with what we've got, I think we can get most people to go where they want to go.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully we can, bottom line is we can get you started and at least get you in the right direction without the, now we got to go back and redo this because you'll be taught right the first time. And then if there's another direction you want to go, maybe we can, you know, head you in that direction to another instructor somewhere else. I don't have banjo or mandolin or anything like that, but I know people that do, so if that time should come, then we can point you that way.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. For the online community, how would people find you to say they want to browse your inventory of potentially vintage guitars or whatever you might have?
I have a site on GBase. It's GBase.com. It's basically a dealer's website. It's run by D'Addario. And I don't have all my inventory on there, but I do have some of it. But there's a map with the directions to the store. The store hours are posted, the store phone number. And there is a smattering of my inventory is on there. So, you know, if you ever want to see or get some idea of what kind of stuff you'll be looking at, get on there, and if there's something you don't see, call me. It may be here in the store, and I just don't have it posted online. And because of the fact, I appreciate all my online customers, because I have customers worldwide that I deal with now on a regular basis, but nothing to me takes the place of doing business face-to-face. I'm just old-fashioned in that way. I like the face-to-face, a handshake type thing, and that I really enjoy that. And I'd rather sell stuff out of here than I would online, but at the same time, I also know there are things that come in the door, and I'm going to have a better shot selling them online than I will out of here. So, you know, it all goes hand in hand, and I think most businesses are that way today, particularly when you're dealing with the kind of stuff that I deal with. Very, very few, particularly vintage type places, don't have some sort of a website where you can go see their stuff. Mm-hmm. Because there's always somebody looking, and you may have that piece that somebody's been looking for.
Very cool. Well, I'm going to post a link to your GBase site.
Okay.
So that people can, you know, from outside of the
sure.
the central Indiana area, they can access you, give you a call, say, hey, I've been looking for this 70 whatever electric guitar or whatever, you know, that they may be looking for, and you may be able to help them hook up with,
and they can
find you and get kids in or folks into.
Sure.
I would say kids, but man, I remember when I first started teaching, I was like 19, 20. And I had a guy, just like you were talking about, he retired. I want to start playing. Want to start playing some of the gospel tunes they're playing at church. And so they're not kids. That guy was three times my age.
Oh, I know.
You know? So.
But music is ageless.
That's
the nice part about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got a customer from over in Illinois, and he made a comment online. He walked in here one day, and there was a kid about, I don't know, 15 years old, and my son, who's in his early 30s, and another guy who's in his early 50s, and they're all three sitting there playing guitar together. And he just thought it was great. He said, this is something you just don't see very often anymore, particularly in a store. And that's the kind of atmosphere that I like here.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. That's awesome. But yeah, I'll post a link to your GBase site so they can call you or check your inventory or whatnot and find you here. And now we probably went a little bit longer than anticipated. if you like, I'd love a part two, maybe a few months from now.
if you want more, just tell Warren and we'll go from there. If not, I understand, and I've enjoyed this one.
I know I'd love to do it again because, you know, I come in here and my wife wonders why. You know, it's like, how long are you going to be? Well,
there's a lot of wives.
Don't know. Yeah. So, well, I really appreciate your time, Dave.
Well, Warren, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. And hopefully we've been answering some questions for some people. And come by if you get a chance and check the store out. Love to see you.
Cool. I'm going to wrap up today's episode of the Guitar Podcast. Please email me with questions at info@theguitarpodcast.net. Comment on the show notes. If you like what you heard today and subscribe using iTunes or Zoom or whatever, please let them know by writing a review, hopefully positive. Thanks again for tuning in. This is Warren Hunt. I'm signing off for the Guitar Podcast.